town years ago when he, you know, he had militarized police, but we're getting there.
This is going to be
a police state if we keep, and I'm just saying, I went to the spring march, the climate march Saturday. I saw maybe five police, and they were just in regular gear, and they were smiling and waving at us.
Okay, we gotta run, Carol. We're out of time.
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, the police are a big problem.
Hey, right on. I can't disagree with you. Thank you so much. Sorry to Linda and whoever else was just calling in to not be able to get you in. You got to call in earlier. But thank you so much. And thank you, Liam, for engineering. We got to get out of here. This is Paul Rowland, Wednesday Talk Radio.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock here at KBOO Portland. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning for public affairs programming. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, Flashpoints, we'll have Dennis Bernstein as your host. And at 11 o'clock, The Bike Show brings you the stories of three women who are creating community and inclusion in cycling. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. And as I said, it's 9 o'clock, and we begin today with The Politics of Living, One Woman's Journey Navigating the ACA While Fighting Cancer. And then author Wendy Sachs talks about how women thrive after changing careers. All that coming up on KBOO after the following announcements.
Hey, Jenna here from Pacific Underground, the show where Asians and Pacific Islanders tell our stories and unpack the issues impacting our communities. Tune in this Friday, May 5th at 9 a.m., where we're going to be talking about how the month of May is Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. While having an entire month is exciting for some, it's a complete eye roll for others. So tune in this Friday to hear the Pacific Underground crew unpack the complexity of the terms Asian and Pacific Islander and debate the benefits of having a Heritage Month all to ourselves. I personally could do without it. Again, that's Pacific Underground this Friday, May 5th at 9 a.m. right here on 90.7 FM KBOO, your community radio station.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of screening of the documentary We the People 2.0 on Friday, May 12th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. We the People 2.0 tells the story of people across the United States who have faced decades of environmental assaults, such as oil trains, pipelines, and fracking, and what they are doing about it. There will be a panel discussion following the screening featuring Portland-based community rights and environmental activists. Again, that's Justice Within Reach on Friday, May 12th from 6 to 10 p.m. at First Unitarian Church Elliott Chapel, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel. Every part of our lives is filled with politics. Food, relationships, work, politics are there. They are in the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the music we listen to. On today's show, we learn about one woman's personal efforts to understand our healthcare system in the wake of her own cancer diagnosis. And we meet a young woman who found her voice as an activist. But first, Denise Kowalczyk chats with author Wendy Sachs about women making big changes in their careers.
Wendy, welcome to The Politics of Living.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I was so excited when I spotted the book in Oprah's magazine, and you were so generous in responding so quickly. So thank you.
Oh, well, thanks for finding me.
You know, I read it in 2 days and not like in 48 consecutive hours. I squeezed in every moment I could to read the book and did it in 2 days. I mean, you know that expression, you know, you devour the book. Well, I did. So...
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's the best thing you could tell me. That's great. Thank you.
Well, when I saw the title from, you know, my own personal / professional perspective, it really resonated with me. And plus, a lot of people, a lot of women that I talk to are, you know, facing really tough decisions or tough options regarding professionally, you know, where they want to go. And so I've been telling everyone about this book, and then we'll be sharing this interview with everyone and their mother. So I do want to apologize in advance. I probably have about 20,000 questions to ask you, but I won't have enough time to do that. So
Start. I've got all the time in the world.
Okay, so great.
I'd love to hear the question.
So I just wanted to start off with you with this question. What was the aha moment, if you will, that moment where you're like, you know, I have got to write this book. I got to get all this stuff together, because it just had, you know, sort of like walking into a brick wall in a sort of pleasant way, if that it can be pleasant, when you realize, you know, you had to get this story or this information out to the world.
Yeah, you know, I mean, really the genesis of Fearless and Free comes from my own personal experience of losing my job. I was over 40 and working as a full-time freelancer, which was sort of strange, but I feel like that's the way that everything is these days. And I was told they didn't have the budget for my position anymore. And I, you know, my industries have been media and news and journalism and communications, and all of those industries have really been disrupted over the past few years. And the idea that I'm out of a job, I'm over 40, and I'm now scrambling, and I started interviewing at, you know, what I call like the bright and shiny startups in New York City. And everywhere I went during this like one period of time, it seemed like everyone who interviewed me had graduated from college in 2009. And I would do the math on that, and I realized that all of these hiring managers were like 27 or 28 years old, and I was ancient. And here I was trying to shoehorn myself into some positions and, you know, talk the talk. And it wasn't that I didn't have the skill set, and it wasn't even that I couldn't necessarily fit into the culture. It was just that the landscape had completely changed, and there's all these new companies, and what I did for a living had now been changed from, like, writing into content and, like, all of these different things happening out there. And after one particularly depressing interview, where I handed my paper resume and the bearded millennial who was interviewing me sort of scoffed at the paper and said, you know, we don't kill trees around here. We only do digital resumes.
Did that happen in Portland? No, I'm kidding.
No. Yeah, it happened in New York City. And, you know, it was like this cliche, you know, the dog roaming through the office and the kale chips and the coconut water and all of that, which, by the way, I'm totally down with taking your dog to work. And I am like a big fan of coconut water, and all of that sort of sits really well with me. But it was like he couldn't get over the fact that I had worked on Capitol Hill as a press secretary, which to me had always been like this entree into big careers. People love that. And, you know, I describe that sort of Capitol Hill experience as, you know, that was like the Google of the Gen X generation. And but he said, you know, around here we don't hang up on the media. We have really good relationships with journalists. And I thought, you know, I'm not a character in the House of Cards or Veep. You know, like, I was begging reporters to talk to me. I wasn't hanging up on anyone. So I had walked out of that interview, and it was at that moment that I thought, you know, I need to reframe my own narrative. I need to figure out how I'm going to sell myself. And I need to change things up. So it was over that period of time where I was really noodling with this idea of writing this book, and I just knew that there were so many women in my position. I mean, men too, who lose jobs and feel aged out. But there's definitely, you know, a gender divide when to how we look at confidence and how we talk about ourselves and how we network and how we get out there. And that was something that I really wanted to focus on, and that's what I talk a lot about in the book.
You know, I was talking to a friend prior to coming into the station to talk with you today, and, you know, she's a woman 40 and above, and is having a dickens of a time trying to find a new job, whereas our unemployment rate, I believe nationally, certainly in Oregon, is the lowest it's ever been ever. And trying to, you know, wrap your head around, like, well, wait a minute, I'm qualified, there are jobs, but why can't I get one? So
right.
I did read a little bit of your Times article.
Uh-huh.
About
ageism.
Yes, and it's really fascinating. I mean, I'm a woman of a certain age. I'm in my 50s and was out job seeking about a year or so ago, and it was a really fascinating experience and trying to navigate, well, I know I have the skills. Is it a fit thing? Is it a gender thing? Is it an age thing? Because you just can't really grab a hold of it so much.
That's right. I mean, and it's something that is happening younger and younger today. And, you know, the whole sort of culture of the workforce has changed. We're also disposable today in a way that, you know, I certainly never felt that way in the first, you know, in the many jobs that I had had. But now things have really changed to the whole gig economy, where people are not expected to stick around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're expected to sort of like burn through your employees. But at the same time, they want, you know, you to be working 24/7, but there's no reciprocity when it comes to that job loyalty anymore.
You are so on it. And I have a related question to that. I mean, I talk to my peers, 40 and above, 50 and above, mostly 50 and above, and they start talking about, you know, I just want to get my next job and coast until retirement. And I kind of am a little puzzled, because I don't think retirement is part of my generation. You know what I mean? In the traditional sense, you know what I mean? I mean, I'm not going to get my pension.
Right.
I'm not going to buy an RV or a house in the da-di-das, right?
Right.
I mean, does retirement exist for, you know, most of us?
I can't even imagine. It feels so far away, and not because of an age thing, but just from a financial security.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are working later and later. And the truth is, you know, we want to stay creative. We want to stay working. We want to stay engaged in the workplace. And we just are trying to figure out how to do that. You know, we want to be compensated for our work. We want to be valued in the workplace. So I don't think too many of the people, certainly none of the people that I'm really, you know, associated with right now, are thinking about retirement. I think we're all just trying to stay relevant. And we're thinking about, how do we get a job and get compensated for our experience? Or how do we go out on our own? How do we become entrepreneurs? How do we launch our own businesses? How do we take our skills and transition them into ways that will keep us fulfilled and make some money?
Have you thought of doing like workshop series, webinars or anything based on your book?
I have, actually. And, you know, I do a lot of public speaking now around the book. And so they're more conversational rather than workshoppy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I've definitely considered that. And I've been approached about doing some workshops.
Okay. Well, I want to mention that Fearless and Free, How Smart Women Pivot and Relaunch Their Careers, is chock full of so many delicious morsels, from, you know, how to reframe or pitch your own story, to all kinds of approaches to how we can help each other, we women. One thing that I loved you citing was the Confidence Code, The Science and Art of Self-Assurance by Kati Kay and Claire Shipman. I read that book, I don't know, about 3 or 4 months ago. Was totally struck by, wow, they hit so many nails on the head. And I just wanted to just touch a little bit on that, because when I talk to my women friends about language, right, vocabulary,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I, by the way, I downloaded that app, that Gmail app.
Oh, you did. That's fantastic. Right.
It is, and I'll put a link on our show page about it. But basically, it's sort of like Grammarly, right? It just says, hey, you made a little
spell check for sorry.
Exactly.
It's a spell check for all those shrinker words.
Or just, right?
And the actuallys and the am I making sense. All of those words that we put in that diminish our power, really. I mean, we think that they're going to be a little breezy and they're going to soften our tone, but at the same time, they're really making us a lot less direct and a lot less powerful.
And you were talking about, which it cracked me up, which is, I think under your section, don't dilute your message.
Right.
So you did some quotes, you know, that are really powerful, but if a woman said that.
A woman said it. Yeah, that came from Alexandra Petrie from the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Who was doing a spoof on famous quotes, you know, Martin Luther King and, you know, all these like big names. But if like a woman said it, you know, how we're going to sort of, you know, try to, you know, just and actually, well, I'm sort of thinking about this. I've got this idea. I don't know what you think. You know, we like completely play down the power of the language because we just want to be liked, and we don't want people to think that we're too bossy or too abrasive or, you know, a bitch, you know.
Yeah.
So we use all of this language and we change our tone because of how we feel that we'll be perceived otherwise. And look, the studies back this up, that women, you know, this is the double bind that women face. This is the double bind that Hillary Clinton faced during the election. That women who, you know, show those masculine leadership qualities of being direct and forceful and powerful, they're not well liked. And those women who show those more feminine qualities of being nurturing and caring and softer, well, they're not thought of as strong leaders. So that's the conundrum.
So, I mean, I know it is a conundrum, but do you think that it is really imperative that we as women, the first step is to reclaim our vocabulary and our power by using our vocabulary? Is it pertinent, necessary to do that?
Absolutely. You know, and it's funny because I actually don't use Tammy Reese's Gmail plugin, the woman who created it, but I do scrub my email. I really do scrub my email because I find myself putting in those little words, those, you know, what people will call those shrinker words, and you take them out, and some of the advice that I've read, you know, some of the good tactics for how do you present with directness and with confidence, but also with warmth, because we want to come across as warm in person and in email. And email is a little tough because there's, you know, essentially no tone.
Right.
But, you know, so other women will drop in a whole bunch of emojis and things like that, which can look a little silly in the workplace. But you start warm and you end warm. And in the middle, you're just direct. And I think that's great advice because, you know, so if you're meeting someone in a room, you're obviously smiling and they see the body language, but then you're direct. And you can also make some sort of personal connection to, you know, how is your weekend or, you know, what are you doing this summer? Make some sort of, you know, relationship, establish some sort of warm relationship, but then be direct in between that. You sandwich it in between warmth.
Yes, and I have been using this approach, if you will, since reading your book, very consciously, and it has made a world of difference just on the inside. You know, I'm feeling, okay, I made my point. My little little phrase would be, could we get together to talk about that project by chance?
Uh-huh.
You know, instead of like,
right.
And I am stopping that. I'm not going to do that anymore. So that
fantastic.
Was
fantastic. Yeah, good for you. And I love that. I love that you got some good advice from the book because that feels great. And I do feel, I like your point also that you feel good about it because it's true. You start feeling a little bit different. You're standing a little bit taller, right? You're just feeling a little bit more confident in the communication. And I'm a wordsmith and I'll reread things 5 times before I press send because I want to get it right, and I want to make sure that I'm coming across as articulate and smart and all of those things. But when you read it and you realize you take out those other smaller words, the just and the am I making sense and the by chances, you know, you look smarter, and it doesn't look harsh, right? You can still end, you know, with a warmly, you know, as your signature. There's a way to do it. And by the way, the guys don't overthink this stuff.
They don't.
They just tell you exactly what they need, what they feel, what you're doing wrong or right. And, you know, they're not overthinking any of this.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do think that we overanalyze, and it's what holds us back, and it's what, you know, really inadvertently takes away our power. I don't think we're looking to become less powerful. I think we just do these things consciously or a little bit unconsciously, because this is almost how we've been trained, and we're afraid to come across as too aggressive.
I know. And that is something that personally and a lot of my women friends, we struggle with. We don't, and we could spend another hour talking about that. So, but I did want to bring up, you were talking about reframing. You know, one of my challenges, and I know a lot of people struggle with this, is ruminating, right?
Yes.
I made a massive mistake at one of my jobs. And oh my gosh, I typically would have spent probably 2 weeks beating myself up. But I took the advice from your book and some other books that I've read to just say, okay, just stop it in the tracks, right? And one of my little tactics was, how would a self-confident person respond to that event? You know?
Interesting. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so I'm like, oh, okay, well, I would have acknowledged the mistake. I would have corrected the mistake, and then I would have moved on, right?
Right.
So can you speak a little bit to what you were talking about in the book about reframing situations?
Yeah, you know, and I love that idea, and it comes, you know, a lot from the confidence code and what Claire Shipman writes about too, mm-hmm. and just how our minds do spin out of control. And I find myself doing this constantly. And, you know, interesting, a little sidebar, you know, this book, Fearless and Free, is not a memoir, but I do insert a lot of my own experiences and my own journey through it. And I truly lived the book. So when I say that, it means like in all of the different areas, from networking to creating serendipity to all of these different things that I talk about, to the branding, to the ruminating, the confidence building, all of that I tried to basically try on and experience. Mm. And so when it comes to that whole idea of, oh no, I screwed up, or, oh God, they hate me, that's why they're not responding to my email, or, oh my God, I've been stalking them, now like they'll never talk to me ever again. Uh-huh. I do that too, because I'm human, and because you can be, you know, you can feel insecure about something and feel bad about it, or feel like you really screwed up. So for me, you know, it's also trying to remove myself from it. So I don't think, you know, I like what you were trying to do. Like, this is, you know, what a self-confident person would do. For me, it becomes almost a gender play. Mm. I try to say, like, this is what my husband would do. He's like a typical guy who really does not feel guilt. He doesn't feel, you know, he doesn't get riddled by, you know, by shame that he did something wrong at the office. He just really moves on. And he would never take it personally that someone hadn't responded to an email. Mm. And he just says, well, they're just busy, or just email them again. Right. And so for me, I really, you know, I now, and particularly because I'm shamelessly promoting my book all the time, there's a lot of rejection out there. There's a lot of going and asking people to for favors, or to do book events, or, you know, can I be on this TV show, or whatever you're doing. And there's a lot of rejection. And there's a lot of just feeling ignored, that you're just not hearing back. So now, really, I'll send multiple emails because I know people are busy. Mm-hmm. So instead of taking it personally, and I think this really applies to, you're looking for a job, you've reached out to someone, you haven't heard back, now you might feel like stupid to reach out again. Don't feel stupid. Reach out again. And maybe reach out a third time. Mm. Because people really, truly are busy. They get flooded with emails during the day, depending on how high on the totem pole they are at that job. And they may not be rejecting you personally. And time again, throughout this whole process, I really found that people say to me, I'm so glad you emailed me again. I was really meaning to reach out to you. I'm so glad you're now at the top of my inbox again.
You are absolutely right.
And hearing that multiple times has just reassured me that I'm not stalking in like in a really annoying way. You can be nice also in your emails. Like, mm-hmm. you know, even starting a subject line of sorry to stalk has really generated a lot of responses for me. I figured I've sort of like really, you know, broken, you know, cracked the nut on like the messaging of how to even approach people multiple times and to just not take it so personally.
You are so right on. In my work as a nonprofit fundraiser, it's never just one email, right? And
right.
I have found, you know, you send a message, they're non-responsive. In a couple of weeks, I circle back and, hey, just checking in on this. And 9 times out of 10, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I did not reply to the first one. Let's get that meeting on the books.
That's right. And then once that starts happening, you realize, like, this is just the way of the world, you know? And I think women, we tend to really think that it's us. We blame ourselves because we didn't get the call back, or we must have screwed up, or they don't like us, or we're not worthy of it. We really just beat ourselves up when we shouldn't be, when we should just, we take a step out. And if we were talking to a friend and coaching a friend on this exact situation, we would say to them, just reach out again.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Exactly.
You've got nothing to lose. But when it comes to ourselves, we can really just feel insecure and, you know, I don't know, just go into this sort of like dark place.
Yeah.
That's just an unhealthy place to be.
So we touched on some of the great stuff about, you know, working on the inside stuff, right? You also dedicated a lot of page to, I'm just going to use a broad stroke generalization about the sisterhood, right?
Yes.
How we can help each other. Again, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, and we were talking about, you know, to a certain degree, our experiences of late have been more lip service than actual sisterhood activity. And so we don't know what that's all about. But I said, oh, well, I read in this book this great thing, a couple of great things that I do. I started doing immediately. So I wanted to touch on a couple of those. You know, the shine theory. I first heard a reference to that. It occurred to me when I was getting ready to talk to you that Gail King actually talked about that several months ago, maybe even last year, regarding her relationship with Oprah, her friendship. So can you share with our audience what that theory is?
Sure. So this is this great concept that comes from a writer named Anne Friedman, who I borrowed this concept from. And her really close friend, Amina Sow, who runs something awesome called Tech Lady Mafia. And it's the concept that women have generally or historically have been, you know, intimidated by those other sort of badass women who seem to have it all together. And instead of trying to befriend them, you're just thinking, oh, well, I'm not going to go over to them. They're like, they must be a bitch, or they must be like, they're too perfect. Therefore, you know, I don't like them. But instead, flip that on its head and realize that you should become friends with the smartest, most attractive, most fabulous women in the room or at that networking event or in the office, because part of their like glow from their halo will shine on you when you become like when they are part of your circle. It makes you look good and you start feeling good. There's like this sort of like mutual benefit that comes from it. And it's a total like reversal of that we're climbing our way to the top, we're catfighting with the other ladies out there. It's just a real switch that we should be really combining forces, amplifying each other's voices, raising each other together. And that's definitely, I've found, a shift in what's happening sort of culturally and in the workforce with women. You know, as I was rising through the ranks, I did not feel, I had a bunch of female bosses, and you know, they were lovely people, but I don't feel like anyone was helping pull me up with them. I feel like maybe it's because there were just fewer places at the top, the pie was smaller. I never felt, you know, inherent catfighting happening. And I worked in a lot of female-friendly, you know, populated industries like TV and news and editorial and stuff like that. But there was definitely no, like, helping amplify other messaging for you from the younger women and really pushing women ahead. But today, and I really do credit millennials for this, there's definitely a sense of sisterhood and feminism, and it's really bubbled up in the past few years. That now some of these, you know, like the Tech Lady Mafia, the one I referred to with Anne Friedman's friend, Amina, they've now codified this whole sort of process. When you go to an event, you're asking and giving. And so it's making you feel comfortable to say, hey, I could really use help with X project or X, you know, thing. And in exchange, you know, I'm looking to help you with whatever you need. So it's becoming this real sort of place where women can exchange and get help and not feeling like you're mooching all the time because you've now codified this whole process of giving and receiving. And it just is part of the program, which, by the way, the guys have been doing always.
You know? Yes.
Men help each other out.
Good old boys network.
Yeah, they've done this. And women, you know, so here's the thing. Women have also always had networks. We've always had villages, just not in the professional sense the way that men have. And that's really what's changing. And the more women feel like it's an okay thing to ask for help, and certainly we've always been givers, but now you should be asking too and telling people what it is you need from them. And I'm running into this more and more. To me, it's becoming more of the norm. And I was just at an event last night, and this woman who was actually part of this women's network that I'm on, but we'd never met in person, I introduced myself, told her about the title of my book, and she said to me right away, what can I do for you? What can I do for you? And I literally like brought tears to my eyes.
Yeah.
And I was like, that is like the greatest thing you could have said to me. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so grateful. Thank you. What can I do for you? You know, and then it's like, but the guys do this. They figure out how they're going to work together. It's
right.
Like, you know, it's a quid pro quo. But, you know, women do this. I think that women historically have also not even liked the concept of networking because it feels so inauthentic. Right? But
right.
We're such great connectors anyway. Like, we really do bond so well. So if we even reframe what networking is and call it, like, connecting instead, you know, even that changes the whole dynamic.
I liked your reference to the amplification method. You touched on it very briefly a few moments ago. Can you describe that to our listeners, what that approach is? I love
it. Sure. I mean, so one of the things that I actually mentioned in the book, and this actually came out of the Obama White House in the early years, and what happened was, you know, the women in the White House and the senior leadership, you know, they would be with the president, you know, at a table, at a meeting, and they would be largely ignored. And this is mm-hmm. something that I think women in all industries can relate to. And they realized, and they sort of like came together, they realized that they needed to support each other. So if Sarah made a point at a meeting, then Jane would say, you know, as Sarah just pointed out, or as she mentioned, or, you know, she just said X. So then Sarah would get ownership over that message, and the women were helping solidify where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they found was that the guys would sort of almost like usurp the idea.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
The women were left silent. The president was rarely calling on women. So they wanted to amplify each other's message. They basically were just repeating what someone said to allow that ownership to go back to that woman. And what interestingly happened was that the president started paying attention to the women in the room, and he started calling on them more.
Interesting.
So this concept of this whole amplification has been, you know, also sort of, I would say almost like inherited or become beloved by so many of the women's groups that I'm now a part of, where our job is to amplify each other's messages. So part of this listserv that I'm on, and there are several women from my listserv who actually made it into my book, is you say, hey, I just wrote this article in, you know, on time.com. Can you guys help, you know, tweet it out? Can you push
yes.
the message out? And they do. It's become a part of what you do to support other people. So whether that's, you know, and it can be across industry, by the way. It's, you know, you're a lawyer who just got recognized or is speaking at a conference, or the, you know, actor who just got a part, or, you know, the woman who's the founder of a startup who is, you know, just raised a new round of seed funding, or she's just coming out of the gate and she wants people to know what she's doing. You know, it's all across industries, but it's just letting people know what you're doing and amplifying that message.
Well, as I mentioned, I was going to ask you 20,000 questions, and we were not going to have enough time to do that. And we've only, you know, skimmed, you know, the surface of what great stuff is in the book. I mean, it's a combination, I think, of really digging deep and then looking at how to, you know, bolster your own self-confidence, really being open to saying, you know, it might look like this, but actually, here's an opportunity here, if you really reframe it, as you mentioned.
Right. And
then how we can actually build upon that energy to really make a huge difference for all women who are, you know, trying to look at, is this by choice or maybe not by choice, what their options are professionally. I do have a final question for you.
Sure.
So let's say you're in a coffee shop and you're eavesdropping and you hear a couple of women talking about, you know, some professional struggle, you know, what to do. And they happen to notice you're listening and they invite you into the conversation.
Uh-huh.
And I know this is going to be a hard question, but what would be, you know, this first response?
This just happened this morning.
No way. Oh, my God. I've been
this
having
happens all the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Can you tell me what happened there?
Sure. Well, I mean, she actually, the woman, to be totally transparent, the woman overheard a conversation I was having with another woman talking about how I was just speaking in Washington, D.C. Yesterday, and I was speaking to a group of female attorneys, most of whom, well, actually almost all of whom are out of a job because they had worked at the Department of Justice, and they worked at the White House under the Obama administration, and now they don't know what to do. And she said, I'm an attorney, too. I work in New Jersey. I worked under Governor Christie, not to get all political, but, you know, there's reason she was like a social justice attorney, and there's good reason why she's no longer working for the New Jersey political machine. And she's also trying to figure out what it is she's going to do next. So, I mean, these things come up all the time, but I didn't even hear your whole question.
Well, I was going to say, if someone, you know, invited you into the conversation, you know, what would you say to them? What would be the a nugget of wisdom, like a first step or encouragement? What would you say to someone who's like, you know, I'm faced with this big thing. What am I going to do with my life as far as professional choices? What would you say to that person?
I think the first thing is, what do you want to do and what are you good at? Now, a lot of people don't know what they want to do, right? That's why they're stuck, and that's why they're, you know, noodling over a whole bunch of different things. But what are you really good at? And then what can maybe you apply those skills to monetize them, you know, to figure out a way to that, you know, works today, if your industry has really transformed so much that maybe your job doesn't really exist anymore, which is the case with the women from Department of Justice, their jobs are mm-hmm. gone. So, you know, what is it that you can be doing with what it is that you do well and what it is that you like to do? And starting at that place, I think, is the way to get started.
That was Wendy Sachs, author of Fearless and Free, How Smart Women Pivot and Relaunch Their Careers. You can learn more about Wendy and her work as author, speaker, and media strategist by visiting her website, wendysachs.com. Angela Majumdar is a cancer survivor who decided to take charge of her care by researching and learning as much as she could about her disease. In the process, she learned more than she bargained for regarding our healthcare system. Contributor Charlotte Fatal recently chatted with her about her personal experiences in navigating the insurance companies and healthcare services in our country.
Angela, welcome to the Politics of Living.
Thank you.
I've known Angela for just about a year now. We met at a book club.
Everyone's invited to it. It's on Facebook. But we have to approve you in case you're a creeper.
Yeah. One of the first things I learned about Angela is her amazing ability to draw you into a story or a cause. And recently we've been hearing a lot about healthcare and healthcare as a public policy. I was drawn to Angela's story about her own healthcare experience. Angela, can you tell us a little bit about your story?
Yeah, I am 34 years old, and I got diagnosed with a cancer that 2,800 people my age have in the country. The total number of people impacted is 18,000, and they're usually above the age of 50. And the only treatment for this medicine was developed in 2012. It was approved by the ACA. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, the prognosis was 2 to 5 years. And in 2010, when I got a similar diagnosis that this evolved from, the only treatment was dying. But you could get a stem cell transplant, but then you have a 50-50 chance of dying. So that's like a last-ditch effort. So this mm-hmm. medicine came out, and it was a miracle. And so when I got diagnosed, I was like, well, at least there's this medicine. And that was literally April of last year. Mm-hmm. And I have a great oncologist, a hematologist at Compass Oncology. And at UCSF, I did not have the best practitioners. And so I'm very lucky to have him. And I can say that moving from San Francisco did save my life because my spleen had become the size of a watermelon in my abdomen while no one was looking. And now it is the size of a orange.
And that's the normal size?
It's double the size. Normally mm-hmm. it's like a nectarine.
Okay.
Let's just stick to fruit.
Yeah.
And but the medicine did that. And so I'm lucky. But then, like, you know, something's too good to be true, right? That mm-hmm. whole adage. Well, I get infections and I have all these side effects. I have high cholesterol now and I'm anemic. And so there's bad things, but there's also the financial stress, depression, anger that comes with ACA times. And ACA, people think about it as insurance, and it's not insurance only. It's Affordable Care mm-hmm. Act, not affordable insurance. Mm-hmm. And the care component comes down to legislation to check evil insurance companies that can be evil, don't always have to be, but often they are. And prior to ACA, they could say, we're only going to cover you for $1 million of coverage, and then you can die or go bankrupt or make hard decisions.
You would reach that $1 million,
wouldn't
you?
In 8 years. The medicine mm-hmm. costs $12,000 a month, and insurance pays, I don't know, 90% of it. Mm-hmm. And then they have this ridiculous program that's ironically called Insight Cares. That's the name mm-hmm. of the corporation, and they don't care. They are willing to pay the gap so that it caps my cost at $25. But if granny or grandpa, the majority demographic that has this cancer, if they get it and they're on Medicare, well, then they won't help them at all. They'll send them to mm-hmm. foundations that can help them. So then you're taking money that was donated to foundations to help people. So that money can directly go into the pocket of the corporation. And just to put it into perspective, in when they were developed as a corporation in, let me look at my notes.
How do they make you not, or how do they make you feel that you they don't care about you?
Well, they care about me, but they only care about me because it's profitable and convenient because mm-hmm. I have private health care through my husband's employer. Mm-hmm. And that's the way that insurance works. So you're part of a collective bargaining pool within whatever insurance group you're in. Mm-hmm. So if you are working at a large company of, say, 5,000, then you have 5,000 people to leverage off each other. If you, a younger person, has no health care, then you're mm-hmm. a very attractive consumer. Mm-hmm. And if I have cancer and it's really, really, really expensive and $12,000 a month just for the medicine alone, mm-hmm. I am not. I am someone no one wants on their insurance plan at all mm-hmm. from a profit level. But most companies aren't horrible. Most employers don't care about that. They prioritize the work that people do, not how much it costs to keep mm-hmm. them healthy if they're mm-hmm. a good employer. And so I just feel like a burden to any insurance plan I'm on. That's like a stressor. Yeah. But anyway, so if there are 20 people that are healthy and there's one person that's unhealthy, mm-hmm. then the insurance is like, okay, well, maybe you're going to pay $500 a month for your insurance plans. And then employers say, okay, well, we're going to pay 90% of that. So you're going to pay $50 a month, right? That would be like an amazing company who mm-hmm. really, really values it and wants to make it a perk of employment is that we give great insurance. Mm-hmm. Getting lost, redirect me.
How much time do you spend researching all of this and how much does time of your day does it take?
I mean, it's like I'm up at night stressed out and then I do research and then I write drafts of letters to my senators because I'm so mad and then I like get sad and then I go to bed.
How did it make you feel about the recent political activity about repealing the ACA?
It's so ignorant. All of it's so ignorant. It's okay. People don't understand it. And I think if they did, they wouldn't behave this way unless they're greedy. And so I think that there are two sides. There's the people who don't understand it, and there are people who are trying to, like, profit from the fact that this cancer company medicine provider, it used to cost $1.97 for a stock back in 1993. Yeah, 1993. It was $1.97. Now the stock is currently worth $124. And that's because every single year they make $2.59 billion with a B dollars just from the 18,000 people in this country that have it, assuming that they are taking the only medicine that can keep them alive.
That's absolutely atrocious.
Yeah, and it's the way our system is built. It's built for the people who have money. It's not built for the people who need the health care. And that, to me, is the part that, like, fills me full of rage. And the fact that they call the program that helps my – it's called copay assistance. They are helping cap my cost at $25. And then they call it they care. And every time I talk to them, I get furious. And I had to stop telling – I had to tell them to stop calling. Mm-hmm. Because every single month, the nurses would call and they'd say, how are you doing? How are the side effects? And I would tell them. And then when I found out – first of all, I'd always ask questions about granny and grandpa because I love old people – because my foster parents were amazing, and so mm-hmm. I just will always love old people, even if they're cranky. Mm-hmm. They probably have good stories and mm-hmm. at least good insults, so that you can remember and then use for people who deserve them, like Trump. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, I get mad when they call, and so for stress reduction, I told them to stop calling. And then what really broke the back, though, is I went on a rant one time, and I was like, listen, I'm getting infections all the time, and I'm tired of it. And is that the medicine or is that the cancer? And they said, well, it's the cancer. And that was a half mm-hmm. lie, like it's both. And then I said, you know, I'm anemic now and my cholesterol's high. And they go, oh, okay, well, is it okay if we document this? Because the FDA likes to know about, like, these stats. Mm-hmm. And so I say, sure, you know, if it helps someone, yes. And so then what happens is they contact FDA. FDA somehow behind the doors, I don't even know if it's legal, contacted mm-hmm. Blue Cross Blue Shield. Then they tried to deny the medicine. They called my doctor and they said, why should we continue to pay for it if it's not helping her? And the answer is it is helping. It's called side effects. And side effects mm-hmm. don't always negate the medicine. It's cost-benefit analysis. And so I came in to see my doctor the next time and he's like, I'm not mad at you, but that was a lot of work just to get you on, to keep you mm-hmm. on your medicine. Mm-hmm. And I learned my lesson. And next time they called, I said, don't call me anymore. I don't need your help. You're not helping. You're hurting. Mm-hmm. And so they don't call anymore. And that's part of Insight Cares. And they don't care. Like, that's the mm-hmm. thing. And then another thing I want to point out is the name of the medicine is Jakafi, J-A-K-A-F-I. I was doing research to write my imaginary letters to Senator Wyden, mm-hmm. and I found out that they changed one letter so that they can sell it for a half cost or less to other countries. Mm-hmm. They call it Jakavi, J-A-K-A-V-I, not F-I, A-V-I. And if you look at the prices, you can Google it on... In India, it's around 3,000. Mm-hmm. In the UK, it's around 5,000. And we
can't believe that.
We, the United States, are subsidizing the cost of all of these other medicines with countries that are reasonable and have socialized healthcare. Mm-hmm. It's called single payer. And so when you're single mm-hmm. payer, one person gets the bill, they negotiate the bill, they say, that's ridiculous, we're not paying it. Mm-hmm. In the United States, there are so many hands in the pot, there are so many cooks in the kitchen that they mess with people in every which direction. If you, Charlotte, go into the ER because you mm-hmm. cut a thumb off, you're going to pay $5,000. That's mm-hmm. your bill. And if I have the same thing, I'm going to get a bill for $5,000. If I have insurance, they're going to send it to insurance, and insurance is going to say it's only worth $3,000. Mm-hmm. If you go in and say, I don't have insurance, your amount that you're responsible for is $5,000. So you, Charlotte, as a one-person entity, have to pay 100%. Insurance pays 70%. Someone who's insured that's pays horrible. 10% of that 70%. The whole system is meant for profit, and that's why people say healthcare for profit is wrong. And when people deny that aren't greedy or wealthy, well, mostly greedy, because you can be wealthy without being greedy, but you can't be greedy. You know, like most mm-hmm. people that are greedy are wealthy because they don't care who they stomp on. And mm-hmm. that's the part that upsets me, because the people who aren't informed are the ones that are raising up their picket signs mm-hmm. saying no Obamacare. The name Obama isn't a curse word. It's a man who tried very hard mm-hmm. amongst a lot of opposition to get protections. Oh, one thing I really want to talk about, out-of-pocket maximum. So one thing mm-hmm. that the Affordable Care Act, not Affordable Insurance Care, Affordable Care Act, it's legislation that protects the consumer from insurance companies' mm-hmm. greeds and the greed of not really pharmaceutical companies, because they still get the whole $12,000 one way or the other. But the way that it works is once you hit a maximum amount of number, usually it's $8,000 a year or $5,000 a year if you're an individual. If you're a family, double that amount. But I have premium health care, fortunately, from my last job, and I'm paying COBRA so that I can continue that premium insurance mm-hmm. plan for my expensive medicine and medical care. But it is $1,150 mm-hmm. that I have to pay out of pocket, and then every single dime is paid beyond that by insurance. I reached that in February.
That's incredible.
So everything that I pay now, I don't pay anything. Insurance has to pay $12,000 mm-hmm. for that medicine. There is no cost to me. Mm-hmm. And normally Insight Cares would pick up the difference up to $25, but they get a break now too. Mm-hmm. So the corporation gets a break because I hit my out-of-pocket maximum, which is whatever, I don't care.
Well, Angela, we've reached about the end of our time, and I'm just so awe-inspired because your story is compelling and really informs me as a person and makes me want to take a stand and try to change it for the better. And I just wanted to ask you if there's any last items you wanted to bring up or talk about.
I just want to say in general, my only wish is that everyone who listens and hears and pays attention to any of these hot topic issues, whether it's environment or healthcare or anything, just starts getting involved. I heard the most effective way is to write a letter, fax it, and mail it, because emails can get deleted, as we mm-hmm. obviously have heard a lot about. Mm-hmm. But you have to file. A politician has to file anything they receive in fax or email or mail, snail mail. So if you do both, it's a 2-for-1. Mm-hmm. You could have a group. You could all write postcards. You could fax them in at one location. Mm-hmm. You know, Kinko's or a free fax machine at an office. Right. And then you could stick them in the mail and you could drink wine and have fun. Talk about a book. Talk about S-Town. Yeah. Talk about a favorite show, Handmaid and Stale.
And Angela, you mentioned to me earlier that you had a blog.
Yeah, it's on medium.com, and it's Angie Says, and then Twitter, Angie Says So. And it'll be up on the website on the KBOO, and I'll put a link mm-hmm. to KBOO, to the interview on my blog. But I'll put more thoughts on there because I obviously have a lot of them.
Thank you so much, Angela.
Thank you.
That was Angela Majumdar speaking with Charlotte Fatal. In our final segment, Bridget Brooks, community organizer, invited Tualatin High School senior Markayla Ballard in to learn about how she became an activist.
We were talking about doing Hands Around the Commons, a candlelight vigil in Tualatin. Mm-hmm. We wanted to be more inclusive, so I did some research and saw an article about you. Tualatin High School student tackles racism with film screening by Jeff Persinger. What prompted you to screen the film Black Girl in Suburbia?
Well, my cousin had suggested that I go see it at a Jesuit high school. And I went, and never had I related to something so much in my life. And it just kind of validated my story and kind of my experiences in suburbia. Kind of brought light to a lot of things that I even didn't really notice, but started to notice afterwards. I know I had a lot of feelings, and I was very angry about certain things.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I knew I wanted to do something, but I never quite... I think it was my sophomore year, the end of my sophomore year. Of course, that was around the time that our school had a lot of black students coming. I don't know why, but we just happened to get some more. And so I was kind of friends with them, and that was cool. And then all of a sudden, there was a website hack. It was posted on social media that our school website had been hacked, and it had, like, I think it said white supremacist high, home of the KKK, and the tabs had been changed to niggers, slave auction, like all these things. And I'd never really seen anything like that, like in my face. You've seen it in the news articles, you've seen it on TV, but you've never actually like seen it in my face.
No, your school's your community and exactly. A safe place for you to go and learn, and exactly. To see something like that would be shocking.
Yeah, and I think the more shocking thing was the reaction that the student body had. It went like viral around our school, and a lot of people thought it was hilarious. It was just a joke. Yeah, and also the lack of kind of action by just everyone in our school that made me kind of realize that I'm the somebody, because there's not going to be anybody else that's going to.
So you grab that's when you grab the reins and
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
so that's when I was
saw your opportunity.
Yeah, a little more vocal.
Transforming those feelings into something positive, awareness
definitely.
Building, community building.
Yeah, for
that's
sure.
Such important work. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to move over to the Tualatin Commons. There was the event, and it was in, I think it was December.
Yeah, after December 10th.
When they reached out to ask you to participate, what was that?
My first reaction when anybody asks me to speak in an event is, oh, snap. Like, I have the worst fear. So at first I was kind of like, oh, I don't know. But I let my passion for activism kind of override that fear. And so I definitely was like, okay, I'm here for this. And I knew that it was going to be sort of a smaller crowd, but it was still people that wanted to listen. They wanted to be there and they wanted to make change in our community. So I'd get a positive response from them. And I went, and it was great. And I do not regret any of it. But yeah, it was a great experience.
What was it like? Just
well, it was wet and raining.
It was. I was there, yeah.
Yeah. But no, it was great. Just like I said, the reaction that people gave and just being able to be there with people that I know have similar interests and more values and things like that and that just want to help. And it was really great seeing those people come out, and it was like a warm feeling.
And then the rain stopped and sort of the clouds
yes.
And the light poured through the clouds. It was such a beautiful moment.
It really was, yeah.
The candles were there, yeah. Passed out, but I just thought you just did a tremendous job.
Thank you.
If you're comfortable, would you be willing to read the piece that you had read?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was kind of rainy that day, like we said, so the beginning of it started off with, I was really worried about the weather today, frizzing my hair, because it takes a lot of work to straighten it. My mom straightens my hair a couple of times per week, and I always tell myself we do it because it's easier and quicker to maintain in the mornings. So while this is true, I also realize there are other reasons that are just as important to why I do it. At a young age, I would wear my natural curls to school, and kids and teachers would touch my hair in amazement. I felt like a petting zoo animal. Who would have thought my poofy curls would make such a statement with impressive amounts of hairspray or whatever gel I had, so whenever I went to school, they could no longer pet me like a dog or call my hair poofy. When middle school came around, I eased up on the hair cementing, and I didn't care that my hair went from Halle Berry to Diana Ross by the end of the day. I love Diana's hair, it's just not my style. From time to time, I straightened it, and people would tell me how pretty it was, and that they thought I looked prettier with my hair straightened. I know I'm here to talk about more than hair, but my point is there are a lot of things that impact life as a person of color in a predominantly white community that go unnoticed by many. Throughout my life, I've been asked the cringeworthy question, are you adopted? People cannot fathom that my white mother is, in fact, my birth mother. I was always stared at during class, during the lessons, discussing slavery or the really awkward reading of To Kill a Mockingbird. Mid-freshman year, I began to realize race came into play a lot more than I'd ever thought. In addition to the racial microaggressions that I had been living with my whole life, there were also outright obvious racist acts and comments. One Halloween, I was asked if I had considered dressing up as a KKK for a hilariously ironic costume. Another shocking question was when a coach asked me why my dad never came to our games, and if it was because he was in jail. There was also the racist website hack at our school, the cruel picture with the black baby from the child development class, and the countless amounts of posts from our students using the revolting word nigger. I've spoken out against these incidents, but most of the time it falls on deaf ears. I've heard, they weren't referring to you, or stop being so sensitive. More need to be more sensitive, and I'm glad to see all the people here, because I am hopeful that we can be the change needed. It's a colorful, complicated world we live in, and I hope we can work out the kinks by getting involved with the people of our community.
Thank you. That was just so moving. I was moved again. Even though I've heard it before, I was moved again.
Thank you.
I love it. There's a book that I studied when I was doing my master's for social work. Mm-hmm. And it's called The Black Community, Diversity and Unity. And mm-hmm. It's written by James Blackwell. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the black community in the United States and that it originally formed in response to white oppression, racism, and repression. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, it's interesting in being a black girl in suburbia. Mm-hmm. There's not that community, even when he's talking about the pluralistic nature of community.
Right. Yeah.
There would be that belonging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot.
Absent.
It's like, it's really different with black people in Tualatin, and because that in itself, like, it's not one community. It's kind of just different kinds of black people, I guess, because there are some that want to be kind of the token black friend that don't really want to touch on the issues of race in our community, and then there are people that do, but it's kind of all over the place. And so when there are black people in Tualatin, it's just kind of, yeah, I don't know, different, I guess. But
and I mean, you had also talked about issues that have arisen since you gave your speech, and aired the film at your school, both good and bad, like doing the t-shirts for Black Lives Matters. Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
Yeah, at the time, my cousin and I are really close, Donovan Smith, and so he kind of reached out to me about the shirts, and then he got me in touch with Teresa Rayford. And she's the, like, leader of Don't Shoot Portland. And so, yeah, it was around the time of Freddie Gray in the trial. And so she asked me to do the shirts and wanted me to have kind of Know Your Rights on the back. So I made a couple different designs for her. We went back and forth and finally came up with the final look. And so it was really cool to see everybody wearing them at this huge May Day rally. And that was really my first protest that I went to. And it was so cool. But it was also really interesting because seeing on the news how they kind of broadcasted it, that they made it seem like it was a really violent thing. And it was just the 5 minutes that there were some crazy people. But aside from that, it was a really peaceful protest.
How long were you there?
I was there for like 4 hours.
Uh-huh.
I did the whole thing, man. My legs were burning, but it was worth it.
So the 5 minutes of disarray made it, but the 4 hours.
Right. Yeah.
So that sounds frustrating.
It really was. But like I have said before, the experience, though, it was completely worth it. And however the news wants to show it, whatever. I mean, that does really suck sometimes to see that. But really, it was that started my whole like journey, and then I really knew that this is what I wanted to do.
What year was that?
That was, I think it was 2015.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is there anywhere that people can find your shirts still?
Yeah, I have a website, and it's just www.markaylaballard.com. So that's where
great.
I post all my
stuff. Oh, good. I'll have to take a look.
Yeah.
And then I think that's where I We'll start here. So I want to say thank you again for taking the time and visiting with me today.
Thank you. Yeah.
That was Markayla Ballard speaking with Bridget Brooks. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our contributors, Vanessa Anderson for technical support, and Liam Delta, our editor. And I'm Kristen Thiel. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's about a half a minute before 10. Time for Chris Andre with Air Cascadia. That's headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, we got Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, The Bike Show brings you the stories of three women who are creating community and inclusion in cycling. And we thank you once more, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one when you go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Chris is getting ready in the next room. We have one announcement to listen to, and then we'll go to Air Cascadia. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO this morning.
Dear KBOO listeners, donate before our next membership drive starts and enter our sweepstakes. Grand prize is two benefactor passes to the 30th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, June 30th to July 4th. This four-day pass guarantees early entry, seating close to the front of the main stage, shade, food and drink coupons, and much more. First prize is gift certificates to Brighton Bush offering overnight accommodations, hydrotherapy, hot springs, and more at the Bright Bush Hot Springs in Detroit, Oregon. Second prize is a Portland Center Stage Flex Pass and dinner at Kale. To learn more about our sweepstakes, go to